why don't you just DL him?
Right. Yeah. That's a good question. And one I don't have a good answer to.
It might be an overdraft, relatively speaking, but I think you sort of have to look at the draft class more holistically.
In addition to Mr. Finfrock, they took Fitz Stadler in the 18th round and Gage Berland.
And welcome to Artificial Turf Wars, episode number 104, where we're still waiting for someone to draft us as a favor in the later rounds. I am your draft-eligible Greg Wisniewski, and I am joined by also draft-eligible Nick Dyka. Nick, how are you doing?
I'm good, Greg, and all those MLB teams out there, feel free to call or email. Yep. Tweet at me, whatever, however you want to get in touch. I am available.
Nick's ringer might be off, but he's watching the phone out of the corner of his eye. I don't know if I would want to continue to be drafted by the Blue Jays at this point, because the Blue Jays are bad. We can quantify how bad as we go down into the show, but they're really bad against their very, very good divisional opponents. We're going to have to talk about that. I apologize, but that's just how it is. Yeah. Sam Gaviglio? Gaviglio? I like Gaviglio.
Sammy good. G.
Sammy G is really good, which is just the weirdest thing so far this season. Marco Estrada, hey, he looked good as well. I feel like Josh should have been here for this. Josh is away this week. Sorry, Josh. We'll still talk about Estrada and say a nice thing or two. And then we'll talk about, is it time to, not to sell, but is it time to talk about selling? We have a question about that a little bit as well. Vlad Jr. is hurt a little bit. Not totally, but a little bit. I have an interview with Jeff Paternostro of BP about the draft. Then we have a couple of questions. Maybe we might finally be on to the change that made the baseball go weird, though we're not 100% sure. And I have a gold star to hand out because I'm a nice guy this week. All right, so the Jays, we'll go right back to the cold, hard facts. The Blue Jays are bad.
It certainly is starting to look like that is undeniable truth for the 2018 season. I know the last time I was on with you and Josh, I was kind of still holding out hope. You know, they hadn't looked good, but I thought they looked so good in April that maybe they could kind of split the difference. And, you know, they weren't as bad as they looked. They weren't as good as they looked. But, you know, a couple of weeks later, it's starting to look like they might be as bad as they've been looking lately.
Well, I think one of the biggest problems is even if they're not as bad as they've been looking lately and they go back to playing slightly above 500 ball, which I think is maybe the true talent level here, it's not anywhere near enough at this point.
No, the Angels are looking awfully good. And, you know, I'm a little bit more skeptical that some of the other teams that are doing as well as they are right now are going to hang in it. You know, that Mariners rotation has been hanging on, and they've been keeping them in games, but they don't seem as good as they've been pitching to date. And I mean, their best pitcher, James Paxton, is obviously, I don't think he's ever thrown 200 innings in a season. He tends to get hurt. So I think the real issue is it's the Angels specifically. I'm still not as, I think when we look up in kind of August, we'll see that the Twins and the Rays and the Mariners aren't showing the records that they're posting now. But yeah, I think that Angels team looks awfully good, and it's going to be hard for the Jays to catch up.
And I think in a typical year where both wild card slots appear to be in play, maybe I'm having a slightly different conversation, maybe a little less pessimistic, but you're right. The only team you're looking at is the second wild card team. And as we record this, the Jays are 11 games out of that second wild card spot on June 7th. Good Lord, not that good, doesn't though. Sound good. And how have they been bad? Let me count the ways. Someone suggested that they, you know, make a list of all the different ways the Blue Jays have lost a game this year after, in the 13th inning last night, allowing two home runs to the two best power hitters probably in baseball off of Joe Biagini. And there was an immediate bounce back that would be too much work because Blue Jays do a lot of bad things. The worst thing here, though, is against every divisional opponent, the people you play most, the Blue Jays have had not a good time at all.
Right. And I think that, again, comes from the fact that two of the best teams in the American League are in the Jays division. And that's the reason, like we were saying, that there's really only one wild card spot in play, because the Red Sox and Yankees are so good that you're going to, most teams are going to lose a lot when they play the Red Sox and Yankees. And unfortunately, the Jays are experiencing that firsthand right now. You know, hopefully, you know, they're playing the Orioles over the weekend. So hopefully that can maybe pad their interdivisional record a little bit. And you know, I'm curious to see how long the Rays are running Sergio Romo out to the mound in the first inning every night. But so there is opportunity to improve. But yeah, with the Sox and the Yankees, the division is just so good that it's, the Jays are going to take some licks, I think, as long as they have to play them 19 times each.
And I think the Jays are about 500. Josh, I usually count on to look these things up, but I believe they're about 500 against the Orioles. And the Orioles are, by any measure, a horrible team. So you would, I know this weekend's coming up with a four-gamer, but, you know, you would have hoped by this point the Jays could at least capitalize on playing the Orioles a lot. That's happening. Right. yeah, so just to be absolutely clear, Jays, I believe, swept in Boston when they went to Boston. And then a little two-gamer swept by the Yankees. So they lost all of the last five games against those two divisional opponents. Yeah. So
silver linings.
Yeah.
Let's talk silver linings.
Okay.
can't all be bad news.
No.
Sammy G, Sam Gaviglio.
Or Gaviglio, depending on how Gaviglio. Italian you feel on a given day.
Yeah.
Don't ask me about pronunciations. I just make them up as I go. Yeah, he has been shockingly competent at this starting pitcher thing.
Yeah, and it's kind of really come out of nowhere. And in terms of, like, you know, he was never a top prospect, to my knowledge, and he doesn't throw particularly hard. It kind of just looks like, you know, this year, even in Buffalo, he seems to be striking out more hitters and walking fewer batters. And that's not due to an increase in velocity or anything like that. But maybe he's unlocked something that's allowed him to kind of rein in his stuff and, again, produce better results. But it's hard exactly to know what to point at that's made him so good so far this year. Again, and he was good in Buffalo, too, not just his 30 innings in Toronto.
So of the five Blue Jays starters, if you look at hits per nine, he's the best at 6.6. If you look at walks per nine, he is also the best. He's better than Jay Happ in terms of issuing walks. And his strikeouts per nine, he's third, but his strikeout to walk ratio is only second, next to only Jay Happ. And Jay Happ is striking out like 11 guys per nine, so it's very difficult. to compare yourself to Jay Happ, who just basically walks in and strikes out the planet now for whatever reason. Yeah. So, again, he's every little aspect of his game is better than all those guys he's going up against on a regular basis, which is pretty crazy. It's probably, if he does it one more time, I would anticipate that upon Marcus Stroman's return, Gaviglio will get the nod, possibly over Jaime Garcia, to keep that last slot in the rotation.
Right. I mean, given how the Jays have been playing, you've kind of got to do whatever you can to win games at this point. And I know what you've done in the past isn't necessarily predictive of what's going to happen in the future, but there's just not a lot of good reason to take the ball out of his hands at this point.
Well, yeah, because Jaime Garcia has the worst whip on the staff. You know, he's allowing hits at a crazy rate. Other than striking a few people out, he's really not doing anything well. It just doesn't make sense to keep giving him a turn if you have, you know, I mean, Marcus Stroman's been awful, but you could definitely chalk that up, I think, at this point, to Marcus Stroman trying to pitch through something, and you may for discover sure. Stroman's a lot better when he gets back.
Right. The other thing with Jaime Garcia is I did a piece for BP Toronto, and I was just looking at all the Jays starters and trying to pinpoint some of their struggles. Jaime Garcia's ground ball rate has plummeted. He's usually like around 50% ground ball rate, and he's down in the like low 30s. And so I think that's a big cause of his problems. And I'm not sure if he's still suffering through some of the shoulder issues he's had, or there's another issue that's kind of causing the problem. But he looks like an entirely different pitcher than he's basically been his whole career, which is a guy who keeps the ball on the ground. And obviously, when you keep the ball on the ground, a lot less bad things can happen.
Yeah. So those two things combined, that's, you know, it's a one good unexpected thing and one bad unexpected thing. So we've laid into Marco Estrada at having problems, you know, repeating the things he's done in the previous years, at least where, you know, after having, you know, the worst start of the season, allowing four runs in 3.2 innings, he did bounce back against that very, very powerful Yankees offense, an offense that he has not done well against historically. And he managed to gut out six innings and only allow one run. So I don't know if Marco's figured it out, but Josh keeps telling me it's a feel thing. So maybe he actually felt right for once. Maybe Marco can build on that.
Yeah, hopefully. You know what? And I know we were talking about when Marcus Stroman returns. You know, depending on how Estrada goes this next time or two through the rotation, I'm going to say this when Josh isn't here, but it wouldn't be, I don't think it's crazy to maybe give the ball to Gavilio over Estrada. I know he did pitch well this week against the Yankees. Hopefully this is the first in a turnaround, but overall it's been an ugly year for Estrada. And, you know, just with his velocity, and there's just no room for error. And I think, you know, we're seeing that firsthand when he struggles this year, and hopefully it is just a feel thing and he can get it back. But it's been ugly, and as great as Monday or Tuesday night was, it's still, if you look at his overall numbers for the year, he's not been pitching well whatsoever.
No. And I mean, but you got five slots, right? So you got to fill them up with somebody.
Right.
So the Blue Jays strategy in April was basically, sorry about the starting rotation. We're going to hand it over to the bullpen, who's going to gut it out, and we're going to hit the snot out of the ball in the late innings and make it work. And that's pretty much all fallen apart on the offensive side. They have no regulars currently with, well, I'll just throw OPS plus out there, which is, you know, 100 is average. There's nobody above 130. Justin Smoke, who is, you know, the team's star hitter right now, has a 128. There's several guys under 80. Your DH is at 59. I don't know what you do with a lineup that is more than half of it is below average. Like, it just, what direction do you look in at this point?
It's tough. In May, they've been 29th in run scoring in all of baseball. So there's literally only one team that scored fewer runs than the Jays in May. It's not looking great, but again, if we're looking for positives or silver linings, it is a lot of the same hitters that were hitting at the snot out of the ball in April. You know, Devin Travis has looked a little better since he's come back. You know, he's hitting about 290. He's striking out a lot more than he usually does, but, you know, he's looked a little better. Teoscar Hernandez has kind of come back down to earth, but I mean, he still looks like a productive-ish hitter. So they're, you know, they should be better than this, even if they're, and I by no means think they're like a top 10 offense or anything, but the Jays should be a little better than this. You know, it's not looking good though right now. And, you know, it's hard to see the struggles of guys like Russ Martin. I'm not sure what needs to happen for him to kind of turn things around. You know, Kendrys Morales is kind of in the same boat.
Like, Russell needs a time machine at this point, I think.
Yeah. and make sure there's two seats so Kendrys can get into
it. Yeah, exactly. Roll back the clock day at the Rogers Center, where we literally roll back the clock on people genetically. It's new, it's risky, but at this point, it's worth a shot. I don't know. Like, I like Russell, don't get me wrong. He's been throwing runners out, which is something he wasn't doing last year. But that bat is woof. It's rough. So ultimately, is it time to talk about selling, do you think?
Right. Well, I think, you know, this is kind of the easy, but I think in a lot of ways the right answer. It's like, it all depends on what you can get. You know, I know I saw somebody on Twitter mentioning how in the past, Mark Shapiro, when he was running Cleveland, did tend to move early in terms of moving players. I think they cited the CC Sabathia trade happening June as opposed to July. I think it depends on what you can get, you know, and that is a big if. Josh Donaldson's not healthy right now. I mean, I know in the off season, a lot of us were talking about how they didn't think that the Jays could get, a top 20 prospect for Donaldson in the off season. And so if they weren't going to get it then, I can't see them getting a big haul for somebody like J.A. Happ. That doesn't mean the market hasn't changed or anything like that, but it kind of all depends on, I think, what you think you can get for these guys. Because if ultimately, you know, you can't really get anything that's going to add significant value to the organization, throwing a qualifying offer on guys like Happ and Donaldson might help bring these guys back for 2019 and 2020. If that's an effective route to go to.
I think for me, Happ is the easy guy to say sell on because he has been doing the thing very well, strike people out, without doing anything bad. And the earlier you let go of J Happ, you know, you give somebody 15 starts of J Happ, I think you could get something of decent value because there aren't a lot of other pitchers out there with contracts expiring. I mean, there is no ace with a contract expiring this year unless you count Chris Archer as an ace, and he's been, to my understanding, a little up and down in that role.
But he's on the DL now, too.
Well, yeah. Forgot about that. Again, Happ is also healthy, which is something that the sooner, you know, you look to move him, maybe the more you get because you're not, you know, someone else is building in that risk of not having options as time goes on. I just don't see, like, either the Blue Jays are buying or selling ultimately, right? Maybe not selling a whole lot because there's not a whole lot to sell, but I don't see them buying a couple of pieces that put them into contention. That's my sort of take on it. It's like what two or three players would fix, quote unquote, this team? Like bringing in a Troy Tulowitzki and David Price equivalent, I don't think that fixes this team.
No. I think to, you know, bring it back, unless they've got one of those time machines you were talking about earlier, they might be just too far deep into a hole to come back, you know. And even if the team does play well, they've dug themselves a pretty massive hole to dig out of.
Yeah, the wrong year to be in that particular hole. I guess we have one more depressing topic before we move on to dreaming on the future. Vlad Jr. is hurt a little bit, like not a lot of bit, not like, oh, a part of his body fell off or exploded, but he hurt his leg and then walked off under his own power. And he was gone for, was it 3 games? Something like that?
Yeah.
And then he came back as a DH. And then he left in the middle of that game because his leg still didn't feel good. It's like, what? It's a 7-day DL in the minors. Why don't you just DL him?
Right. Yeah. That's a good question. And one I don't have a good answer to. And
so it's both of us, really.
And I think and honestly, with the team playing as bad as they are, I feel like all the collective Jays community is following Vlad more than they're actually following the major league team at this point. So get him healthy and get him on the field somewhere. I mean, we obviously know ideally that's in Toronto, but don't get him healthy. Don't take any chances. He's too precious of cargo to run him out there if he's not feeling 100%.
Yeah. And I mean, guys are going to get hurt. That's just you play, you're going to at some point get injured, small, you know, pulled hamstring or tweaked knee or ankle or whatever, or big, you know, and that's, I always find it funny when people think, oh, let's just get this prospect up here and he's going to play and he's going to be fantastic. Well, always tag if he's healthy on the end of that, which I don't think happens often enough. There's just sort of this assumption that you can't get hurt until you're on the big league team or something. I don't know. It's like,
yeah.
All those risks are there. It's like when you call up an arm for the bullpen. Oh, they need a fresh arm. Well, okay, that guy was pitching in Buffalo. he probably pitched recently. It's not like he's been sitting around all week going, man, I wish I could pitch somewhere.
He's got his arm wrapped in bubble wrap, waiting for the call.
It's not like the bullpen phone's just ringing in Buffalo. Nobody will pick it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm far too removed from the situation to comment in it with any kind of speculation or anything, but I know I have listened to people who are closer to the game, you know, people like, you know, Saris talk about how when you do have a bigger body, which I think that is fair to say Vlad has a bigger body, that you are more prone to injuries and things that can keep you off the field. So I think maybe this is a kind of maybe a little reminder that Vlad might be hurt, you know, more often than an average player again. And that's not to say that's going to happen. It's just that, again, over large periods of time and large swaths of data, people that are, you know, carrying more weight tend to get injured more often.
And by all accounts, Vlad Jr. is a bigger boy than his dad ever was. And I don't know if I'd ever want to run into Vlad Sr.
No. Yeah.
So the Blue Jays did have a draft, and I have an interview about the draft. But did you have any just sort of overall impression of the draft or anything you read stand out to you before we go in depth with it with Mr. Paternostro?
No, not particularly, other than I think that the Jays are on to the next market inefficiency, which is drafting the sons of major league players. It's Sonny Ball, as we were talking about online.
Sonny Ball, there we are. So yeah. I do discuss whether Sonny Ball was the big factor with our interview coming up right now. So we'll get right to that. And I am pleased to be joined by Jeffrey Paternostro of Baseball Prospectus, because we're going to do a little draft talking, and as usual, I'm a bit lost when it comes to the draft. So welcome to Artificial Turf Wars, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
A pleasure that you could make it and stop by. So the Blue Jays have had a little bit of an unconventional draft, I guess. So why don't we start at number one, their very first pick, which was, what was he? Overall, 12th overall, Jordan Groshans, who is a shortstop, third baseman. Apparently, this guy was not really on anybody's first round board.
Yeah, so I don't pay a ton of attention as a general rule to big boards, because in a lot of cases, you're looking at these as sort of like aggregate from scouting and coaching sources, and any individual team's board is going to be a little bit different, and it often just takes one to really buy into a guy. And also you have sort of the nature of the bonus pools, and I could see Groshans being a little bit under slot given sort of the shape of the rest of their first few picks. I can't say that for sure, and historically speaking, I'm terrible at actually predicting this game. You know, talking to some scouts that did see him, they definitely had him more of a second round guy. You know, I see him as a third baseman long term because of the frame. Everybody's a shortstop in high school, as I like to say. He's a power over hit guy. A comp that I heard come up is Hudson Potts in the Padres system.
Okay.
Is that really what you want at 12? I don't know, but he's a very good prospect. You know, chance to be a regular dude at third base with some pop. And, you know, looking at what they got the rest of the way, I don't think you can just look at, you know, pick 12 and he was ranked 31 on MLB's top 200 and say, well, this was an overdraft. It might be an overdraft, relatively speaking, but I think you sort of have to look at the draft class more holistically.
So he isn't an isolated pick, like you said. So I guess he's really tied to maybe pick three or pick four. But the second pick we should not skip over, because the Blue Jays did something that they I guess are suddenly famous for doing. They picked the son of a former major leaguer.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the actual strategy. The but
So yeah, Griffin Conine is Jeff Conine's son. Has a tremendously Duke University name too. But had a good Cape Cod season last year. Led the Cape in homers. Was seen, I think, probably coming into the college season as one of the better college bats in the draft, maybe not sort of on the top tier of the guys that went like in the top five or six, but certainly a first round pick. And then he started selling out for power. He has a lot of power. You know, it's plus raw, despite, you know, not being a huge guy with big strength or big levers at the plate. And he had a really sort of bad start to the season in the ACC, you know, worked it out from there, showed more of sort of the first round pedigree in the second half of the season. And, you know, I think probably the Jays got a nice little piece here, given when they drafted, you know, sort of the, you know, the converse of the Groshans pick. You're buying the bat here. He's fine in right field. He's going to need to hit for a lot of power because he's a corner outfielder. You know, you like the bloodlines, you like the raw, you know, you send him to Dunedin next year and you just see where you are.
Do you think maybe the Blue Jays saw something that wasn't broken when they first looked at him and then he broke it in terms of selling out for power and they think they can fix that?
I think you know we're in the midst of the launch angle revolution, as they like to say. So you look at the skills that guys get paid for in Major League Baseball and certainly in the draft as well. You know, it's big power for hitters, especially if you're a corner profile like Konine is. And it's big fastballs, velocity for pitchers, and I guess now spin rate too, to a certain extent. You know, that's certainly always in these. Look, these guys read their press clippings. They know what's going on. It's in the back of their mind that, you know, was he pressing to have like a big junior season to move up draft boards and sign out for power a little bit? It's certainly possible. Could also just be a 25 game blip. You know, he just sometimes it's just bad timing, and you have a bad stretch at the beginning of your junior season. When you're, you know, when all eyes are on you. I think, again, much like with Groshans, you're looking at a potential, you know, everyday regular in the majors where the sort of the power end of the bat is going to have to carry the load.
Fair enough. So the Blue Jays strategy maybe comes into, like you said, more of a holistic focus as we get to pick number three, which was 88th overall. Adam Klopfenstein, who in a curious twist is actually a teammate of their first round pick.
Yes, they're both from out of Magnolia High School in Texas. Does that really move the needle in terms of getting these guys signed? I think it's a nice story with them coming up together. I'm sure you'll see features written about it because it's going to be an easy feature for somebody on March 15th in spring trading when you might need an easy 1,000 words. But, you know, ultimately you're not taking this guy if you don't know you can sign him and know what his number is. He's going to take a lot of money to sign. That was sort of the report coming into the draft. The Blue Jays weren't the only team on him even earlier than the third round. And one of the reasons he dropped as far as he did was likely his asking price. But again, if you're taking this guy in the third round, you think he's signable and you're signing him because he's a gigantic kid from Texas. And those dudes that, you know, gigantic kids from Texas that can hit 95 coming out of high school are always in demand. And there's always a lot of them, funnily enough.
So, yeah, he is only 17 years old.
Yeah, he is a younger guy. So there's some projection left. You know, normally you think of a 6'5", 17 year old Texan, you're thinking, oh, well, you know, he can grow another inch or two and the frame fills out and might add some velocity, and that may happen, but he's a big boy. He's not like a Dustin May-esque or Noah Syndergaard-esque string bean coming out of Texas high school. But, you know, conversely, he's a little more advanced than those guys. He's got three pitches, good command, good mechanics, could be a faster mover than your average, you know, third round or second, third round prep arm going forward. So that's something to keep an eye on, like how hard they push him despite his young age. I mean, normally you see these guys in this general range go, you know, stay in the complex July and August, pop up in extended spring, and then go to one of the short season affiliates for their first pro season. It's not impossible they push him to to the Midwest League if he shows well. You know, this stuff works itself out in the next 9 months. But, you know, he's not sort of your traditional big, projectable body you can dream on Texas prep righty. There's a little bit of that in there, but it's not like there's some polish there as well, which is nice with that pick.
I was going to say, he doesn't appear to have any real warts. Like, when you look at the scouting grades that we have over at BP Toronto, he's, you know, fastball is 60. Everything else is a 55 or a 50. He seems well-rounded for a kid who is only 17.
Yeah, it's not going to be, it's not a case where he's got huge, huge stuff, or even like a huge, huge projection to stuff. He's just a big kid that throws hard and knows how to pitch, and it's a nice prep arm where they got them. So sort of, I think if you look at the first three picks as a unit, it's a nice bit of drafting. You know, you have some balance there. You have the more advanced college bat. You have a power hitting, prep shortstop that's going to be a prep corner guy, and you've got a big prep arm as well.
All right, so. Possibly in less detail, we will touch on round four pick Sean Weimer, another right-handed pitcher. Thoughts on his projectability?
Sean Weimer is every fourth round college pick, which is, I don't mean it as a slight, but it sort of is. It's just, he was in the bullpen in TCU, started some this year. It's a major college program. That's a lot of good arms that have passed through. He's got four pitches. He's pinned either side of 90 for the most part. He's polished. It's not a ton of projection. He's a shorter righty. You know, these guys tend to end up in sort of a weird in-between spot where it's like, is there enough stuff / command here to start? Occasionally there is. There's not a clear relief fallback. Like sometimes you'll get a guy that's like, in the fourth round that's, up to 95 and has a pretty good slider, but his command's a mess, or there's been durability issues in the past. Like, it'll play up in relief. He could be an eighth inning guy. Weimer doesn't have that kind of stuff. So you just kind of, set him on his way as a starter in the minors and see where it goes from there.
All right. And then the last guy that I was thinking about here, talking about, was round five pick Christopher Beck, who is notable to me because he appears to have a K missing off at the end of his last name, and nothing else. He's a catcher who, as I have a note here, it says he did not make Baseball America's top 500, but he was drafted 146th.
He is a senior sign out of the University of Maine. I actually saw him when they were down here in Hartford, because I was seeing Jeremy Pena, who I think went in round 3 to Houston. He's Geronimo Pena's kid, if you want to feel old, as I do every single day. I do this now, especially on draft day, let me tell you.
Oh, yeah.
So I wish I had more information for you on Christopher Beck. I recall him having a really excellent mustache at the time.
Ooh.
He had some flow and mustache going on.
Excellent.
As I recall. But I can tell you that he's a senior sign in the fifth round where the pick value is 357,000. He's probably not getting that. So this is a bit of accounting, essentially. They also took senior signs in the ninth and the 10th round, which I assume are going to be, of the 10,000 variety, to clear another couple hundred thousand. Beck will clear that on his own as well, because they're finding money for the most part, Klopfenstein here, based on what I heard before the draft on what he was fishing around for a bonus. So I'm sure that's just, sometimes these guys make it. Absolutely. But this is, good for Christopher Beck. He is going to spend some time in the Northwest League, probably. And then, it's a bit of, it's actually not all that dissimilar from being in Portland, Maine, honestly. So I'm sure he'll, the mustache will fit right in, certainly.
Well, the Jays are notoriously horrible at developing catchers with any consistency, as I'm sure a lot of teams are.
Danny Jansen's good. I like Danny Jansen.
Yes, Danny Jansen appears to be the exception rather than the rule, as Max Pentecost.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Reese McGuire, Max Pentecost.
I don't know if we're going to slight J.P.R. and Civi at this point or not, because he did make the majors, but yeah, that's another story.
He had a nice, he had an okay career. J.P.R. and Civi is a developmental success, I guess.
So in that light, I'll ask you my final question, which is more of a philosophical question. Do you think major league teams are getting any better at this draft thing? Because unlike the other major sports, we pointed out over and over again, the draft after the first two or three picks, not rounds, picks, is way more of a crapshoot in baseball, it seems, than any other sport.
Yeah, I think you have to... I mean, the short answer is no, based on the majority of the research I've seen. But it's also a changing system with the way the draft pools have changed. The last two or three CBAs. It used to be even as of 2011, you could really spend whatever you wanted in the draft, and all it would get you was a stern phone call from the commissioner's office. Now we have these draft pools with suggested slots. You know, the teams manipulate by doing things like taking Christopher Beck in the fifth round. And we don't have a system where... So, I mean, I guess the idea of a draft is that you are allowing the worst teams to get the best players in an attempt to, maintain competitive balance across the league. Really, as we know, it's to hold down player salaries and player costs. Mm-hmm. But, in this sort of world, this theoretical fantasy we've constructed, the system we have now doesn't really do that, because look, Casey Mize went 1-1. We can hem and haw about pitchers versus hitters and whether you might find someone that liked Nick Madrigal more. Absolutely fine. You might find someone that liked Joey Bart more, or even Alec Boehm. But for all intents and purposes, the best draft prospect went to the worst team with the number one pick this year. That tends not to happen in this system, because for the Tigers, there's certainly a scenario where the Tigers could have signed, Jonathan India, who went number 5 overall to the Reds. They could have signed him for $5.5 million, which is probably more than he'll make going number 5 for the Reds. And a lot of people had him going either 5 or 6 in their mock drafts. And they've saved $3 million to spend on other players, throughout the draft. And they did not get the best player in the draft. But the nature of the baseball draft is you don't necessarily even want the number one best player. If it's a generational player, like Bryce Harper or Steven Strasburg or someone like that. Mm-hmm. You want as many opportunities to get a good player as you can. And because of the way the draft it falls off, you can look at the drafts of average player war for the first 30 picks and even beyond that. But if you're pushing guys that are top 15 talents further down because you can offer them more money, that gives you more shots at, developing a star. The one thing the Astros did, and we can look at sort of like the Astros roster as constructed and debate how much the hard tank they did actually contributed to their World Series winning team. Being able to get Carlos Correa at 1 under slot, and also getting Lance McCullers in the second round because of that, was a big factor. Now, it was a weird draft. Some people did think Carlos Correa was the best prospect in that draft. I mean, there were 6 guys that could have gone number 1, and the Astros found the one that they liked that would meet their price for what they wanted to pay under slot there. And make the rest of the draft play out the way it did. I think they also signed Rio Ruiz, who they traded for Evan Gattis, I think. So that gives you a third guy there. I think Ruiz wasn't the only one in that deal. So are teams getting better at identifying these players? I don't know. But they're getting better at figuring out ways to get more good players into their system. This is sort of the Paul DePodesta and the Cleveland Browns argument. We actually don't think we're better at drafting, so we just want to get as many picks as possible.
Mm. That's food for thought. All right, folks. I would like to thank Jeff Paternostro and remind you that if you enjoy his take on prospects, you can follow him on the Twitter @JeffPaternostro. You've made it very easy. It's no spaces, no underscores, nothing.
Yeah, it just, I think it's the exact number of letters I can actually use on Twitter too.
Perfection. Perfection indeed. Or you could check out his stuff, of course, at Baseball Prospectus. Thanks for joining me tonight, and I hope you have a good one.
Well, thanks for having me. I think it was the first Blue Jays hit I've ever done and not talked about Vlad Guerrero Jr.
Well, now you did.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, have a good one. And we are back. And yeah, so I think an update on the mustache and flow of a prospect at this point is probably just as relevant as his batting stance and or fielding ability. So we got that. I mean, yeah. You know, we got at least one mustache flow update, which, I mean, you've got the mustache and beard working, so you know how important that is.
Yeah. So my question would just be, do you think he's older than he's suggesting he is, given that his mustache and flow are so strong? Because you don't see that a lot with 18 or 19 year olds.
I can't remember if he was the college sign or not. But yeah, it, I don't think it's as suspicious as if he had come from a country in the Central American place where area where they're a little fast and loose with the birth certificates. Regardless, I'm not accusing anyone of identity theft. I'm accusing you folks of asking us questions and us answering them.
Time now to hear from our listeners.
That just seems silly.
Here are the rules. First, I ask a question, then you ask a question.
Now, how does that sound, sweetheart?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, all right. Right off the top, we have Josh, who I believe is a new question asker. I do not know at Trick or Treats, which is T-R-E-I-T-Z, if you'd like to follow Josh. What players on this current roster, we have to have one Josh per podcast. I just want you to understand that. What players on this current roster would you be uncomfortable trading right now? Do you have two or three who you'd be like, I don't think so?
Right. I think that you'd probably want to hold on to Stroman and Sanchez, just given that, one, you have more control with those two than you do with a lot of the players on the team. And two, their values are just so much lower than they could be right now. You know, with Stroman hurt and Sanchez not pitching well, it seems like it would be a real, you know, sell low opportunity to try to trade them now. So I'd hold on to them for sure. And plus, you need somebody to pitch next year for the team.
This is maybe going to be an issue. I think I hang on to Teoscar Hernandez. And for sure, Justin Smoke, I would still not be comfortable trading because he's stupid cheap for, I believe, one more year. I believe in 2019, he's still ridiculously underpriced.
Yep. Best option in baseball for next year. I think it's like $3 million.
The best something in baseball. It's one thing. What do you got for me next? I should ask you this question. It's Vlukimir Guerrero Jr. at Split Letters. Rate the Jays draft picks by quality of name, which also, in addition to flow and mustache, is another important metric at this point in their careers.
That's right. And the Jays International Scouting Department did some very good work late in the draft this year when they took with the pick in the 29th round somebody named Sri Finfrock. C-R-E is his first name, so I think I'm saying it right, Sri. And in addition to Mr. Finfrock, they took Fitz Stadler in the 18th round and Gage Berland in the 22nd round. So if anybody is looking to check into a hotel under a pseudonym, those are some good recommendations.
Now, I gotta ask, how many people name their kid Fitz these days?
Yeah, I always thought Fitz was kind of like a nickname. You know, like if your last name was Fitzsimmons or Fitzgerald or something, then, oh, it's Fitz.
Yeah,
I didn't see it as a first name, but hey, you can name your kid whatever you want, really.
Yeah, well, yeah, and you can apparently spell it however you want these days, which is, I gotta confess, starting to get on my nerves just a little bit. Like, you're just making it tough for everybody. You're making it tough for the kid who has to spell his name all the time. You're making it tough for me, who has to ask all the time when I assume that I know how, like, Jeff or Fred is spelled. Anyway.
Right.
Yeah, or the 17 different ways you can spell Casey.
There's a bunch.
I may have gotten off of topic. Perhaps we should go back to a question from our listeners who are, you know, the real stars of this section. Kate Stanwyck at OK Stan asks, it's a question we had touched on earlier. Is Sam Gaviglio for real?
It's kind of hard to say so early on, but again, if you look at his entire minor league career, there's nothing that screams he's capable of doing this. But at the same time, if you look at his like peripheral stats like FIP and XFIP, they're both under 4.2. So he hasn't been getting particularly lucky. It's just that the things he's been able to do are just new for him. You know, he's never struck this many guys out, never walked this many guys, never stopped walking this many guys. So it's hard to say, but usually performance like this doesn't come out of nowhere. So it's, if you were a betting woman, Kate, I wouldn't bet that he's going to continue to have an ERA under 3, striking out 9 guys per 9 innings.
No, I think you have to ask the question, how good is his command really in the long run? Can he keep repeating and repeating and repeating? And like you said, his minor league career says no, he can't keep repeating that low walk rate. And of course, the low walk rate will tie into the home run rate and the strikeout rate and everything else. So if you watch for that to tick up, I think Sam has a problem. But until then, Sam is still better than all the other options out there, even if he regresses a bit.
Yeah, my best guess would be a good season for him would be if he can keep his ERA under 4, you know, and keep his K rate north of 8 for the year. I'd say that's a pretty successful season for him.
Indeed. What do we got next?
All right. So from the Blue Jays Village, they ask at Blue Jays Village, for the remainder of the season, New Hampshire plays at the Rogers Center and the Blue Jays play in New Hampshire. Thoughts?
That sounds fun. I think really you're focused on like 2, maybe 3 guys on that New Hampshire team playing up here, because I pretty much am sure that the New Hampshire pitching staff gets slaughtered by Major League Hitting.
You think you don't like Joe Biagini out there facing Stanton and Judge? Wait till last year's Fitz Stadler, who was drafted in the 18th round, pitches against them. Whew.
Yeah. So I think as much a novelty as that would be for a week, I do not think the remainder of the year would be anything that anybody would actually be buying tickets to by August. Sadly. Yeah. Now that said, I think there are probably 2, maybe 3 guys who you could try out there before September and see what happened. But they're all very young. Even Biggio, who's, I believe, 23, is younger than you would expect necessarily to make that jump from AA right to the majors. So for what it's worth.
That's right.
Last question. If either of you were to take someone to their first ever MLB game at the Rogers Center, and to be fair, I've only ever attended an MLB game at the Rogers Center, and they're a baseball noob, what would you try to do to make sure they have a very positive experience?
Right. Well, for me, I would try to engage them with as many kind of community elements that surround the team and the Rogers Center as possible. You know, I'd make sure that they go see the guy playing the drums outside. Was it gate usually 7? I'd maybe try to take them to a bar that's really close to the stadium beforehand, so they can kind of, again, get the feel for fan culture and things like that. And then most importantly, I'd make sure the game wasn't in 2018, so they didn't have to watch the 2018 Blue Jays. Yep.
Solid strategy. I would add 2 things there. One, I would make sure that we had food either that we brought in with us or that was from around the stadium as opposed to in the stadium. Although there are good options in there for during the game, I think you want to bulk up on the food, and there's a lot of good food in Toronto. Before you go in, before you spend $11 on a hamburger with like 4 french fries. Yeah. Because they let you do that. And as much as it says on your ticket you can't do that, no, go right ahead and do that. I think I would tell them to, for the first game, don't worry about bringing your camera. Camera's not going to help you. It's just going to distract you. If they're really a baseball noob, I would buy a program. I would show them, as much as I could about the players who were going to be playing that tonight. Get there early enough to show them the warm-ups. The opposing team you're usually watching do, you know, batting practice. That's kind of lets you get settled in. And then lastly, I would get a ticket in the 200s behind home plate or down one of the baselines. I think that's the best view in the Rogers Center. You're high enough up that you can see everything that's going on the field, but you're close enough that you get an idea of just how fast the action is on the field.
And you know what? If I can add something to it too, I'd say spend a little bit of time in the flight deck. I feel like that's kind of the most social area of the Rogers Center as it's currently configured. We'll see what happens when Mark Shapiro gets his millennial hangouts installed, but until then, go to the spend a little bit, an inning or two in the flight deck too.
Millennial Zone Part 2. They should just name Millennial Zone 2 Millennial Zone 2 and see who shows up.
Yeah. Yeah. Family Center 1. Yeah.
It's so romantic. I just wanted to touch on yet another the baseball is different thing, because I thought this article was fascinating. First of all, it's in The Athletic. Second of all, it's not paywalled, which is pretty cool because just about everything in The Athletic is paywalled. It was written by, and I have it here, Dr. Meredith Wills. She wasn't able to get as many baseballs perhaps as the official committee run by our friend of podcast Dr. Alan Nathan was, but she took the baseballs apart into their component pieces and took a look at each piece. The most significant change here that nobody's really looked at is the thread that is used for the seams has a thicker diameter by, I believe, more than one standard deviation, but you can read the article, which means that it's possible that how tightly... Now, this is not seam height. That's different. How tightly the hide is on the ball might be different. And it would also maybe explain why some pitchers who are gripping along the seams are getting more blisters is because the actual thread is thicker for each little stitch. That could also explain that the ball being tighter is less prone to being distorted when it's hit. And of course, a rounder ball flies better and a little bit farther. That's all a bunch of guesswork, and maybe someone will have the chance to go down. But just another thing, I was fascinated, another way to look at changes that might have happened to the ball without anybody really noticing.
Somewhere out there, Rich Hill is nodding his head in agreement with you, Greg. And
Rich Hill knows what's up.
Yeah.
To avoid all of this going, I guess, spiraling out of control, Major League Baseball bought Rawlings for $395 million this week, which...
That's right.
Yeah, according to the Wall Street Journal, part of that is so that they can get a handle on what goes on with the ball directly. And I think probably a sports league supplying its own equipment, that seems to be to make sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. I'm curious to know how that's going to affect players and Rawlings baseball gloves, because I know Rawlings gloves are still definitely widely used in the majors, and I'd be curious to know if kind of the quality is going to go up or down now that basically players are buying gloves from their owners if they choose to use Rawlings.
Yeah, that's kind of weird, but... I mean, that's not the worst thing that can happen. I guess you got that quality control issue as well that you can now complain directly to your MLB ownership if things go a little sideways. Lastly, I was going to throw out a gold star because we haven't done one in a little while.
I think that's rather brilliant.
So I did good, right?
I mean, I would have thought you'd get a gold star.
You enjoy that. You've earned it.
So you tell me pre-2018 about the Blue Jays... specifically Twitter account, but the Blue Jays general social media strategy. How do you think people felt about that strategy?
You know what? This kind of ties into all that talk about the Twitter study that got released last week. I don't know that I pay as much attention to the Blue Jays actual social media accounts as I do, again, just people I know that comment on the team and, you know, the odd player, but even players I don't follow very often. So I might be the wrong person to ask, Greg. I mean, they do a good job at conveying all the important information, like what time games are starting and who's pitching and things like that. But aside from that, I don't follow them too closely.
But you know that in previous years, the Cleveland Indians account and a couple of the Oakland A's account, sometimes even I believe the Brewers, there's been some back and forth.
I've seen that.
The Blue Jays were never in on any of that fun with their Twitter account. It was, like you said, it was at first it was strictly informational. And then when it tried to be one thing or another, it would generally be like three innings too late. And they were showing like an old highlight from like 2 weeks ago that didn't really apply because the guy was in the wrong uniform. Yeah. And there were a lot of things. I don't want to say tone deaf because that makes it sound like they were rude or something. But there was just sort of this like the person working the account was really busy with a lot of things, but had committed to run the account. So they were going to do it. And again,
it was Ross Atkins.
Yeah, exactly. My apologies to whoever ran the account at this point. But I just want to make clear that there is a significant difference this year. They respond to people who tweet about the team. Like there's a real person on the other end who is an actual Blue Jays fan who understands what's going on. The highlights that they give, usually in GIF form, are actually from earlier in the game. Like you would expect them to be, not from like some stock photo inventory that they have. And they've done something so far very difficult. They have remained positive and cheerleadery because I don't think an official account can tell you that your team is crap and you shouldn't watch. You know, which we might feel that way sometimes as fans. They maintain that positivity without ignoring the fact that, you know, the Blue Jays, yes, might be behind or might not be in the best situation, you know, this series or this game or whatever. That focus on tomorrow when things aren't going well. To do all of those things right after years of having sort of kind of just left them to blow in the wilderness, I think deserves a gold star. So shout out to the Jays social media team. You guys, because I assume it can't just be one person at this point, you guys are doing a bang up job, and I hope they keep you on, you know, for years to come, because it's worth following that account now. If you don't, it definitely has a nice little spin to it.
Yeah. Maybe I should be following it, now that I know they're actually kind of upping their game.
Yeah, you should hop on. And then next time we have you on, you can tell me whether I wasted your time or not. Okay, so we come to that point in the show where, wait, it's not really a show, I guess it's a program because you're not showing people anything, but we come to that point where I ask Nick if he has a final thought.
Yeah, actually, to continue raining praises down on our last place team, I just want to say kudos on the Jays for having a pride night at the ballpark. It's tomorrow night against the Orioles. I will be there. I'm excited to go and see what they have planned. And yeah, it's about damn time. And it also, like everything you were saying about their social media team, they seem to be kind of responding to the kind of needs and the wants of the fan base in a positive way. And just aside from all of the corporate gobbledygook, I think it's just a really amazing way to integrate different parts of the community into the baseball experience. And I'm looking forward to being there.
And I agree with you totally that, you know, getting the right community message out there is certainly not going to hurt in terms of, you know, attendance and who feels welcome at the ballpark. And that's important, especially when the team on the field, the product does not match up to any of those expectations at the moment.
That's right.
I do not have a final thought this week. I think I'm just going to leave that for when the Jays have won back-to-back games, which they have not done since our last podcast, which they had not done since the end of April. Sure, they can figure that out, maybe against the Orioles. That said, this has been Artificial Turf Wars, episode number 104. I have been Greg Wisniewski at Coolhead 2010, and you have been Nick Dyka at Nick Dyka, and our guest was Jeffrey Paternostro at Jeff Paternostro. Funny that. From Baseball Perspectives, we thank him very much for giving a in-depth look at the first little bit of our 2018 Blue Jays draft. That said, we will talk at you next week.